Adam Hochschild grew up in a world of wealth and privilege. His father was the CEO of a large multinational corporation that owned mines in southern Africa. But Hochschild viewed the world differently. He thought big business was boring and exploitative, and he went into journalism instead. He became politically active in the anti-war movement and wrote for Rampart's magazine. In 1974, he co-founded the leftist magazine Mother Jones, using family money. He's brought together the world he knew as a child and the way of life he's chosen for himself in his book Half the Way Home, a memoir of father and son. It's just been published in paperback. I asked him if he's finally come to terms with his past.
In a sense, although I must say I'd sort of come out in bits and pieces in the pages of Mother Jones over the years, because there were a couple of chapters of the book that had appeared in the magazine, so I think to many people it was no secret what sort of past I'd come from, but I did kind of put it all on the table and Half the Way Home in a way that I hadn't before.
How did your family make their fortune?
Well, my father was in the mining business, and his brother and his father also worked for the same company, a big multinational, which today goes under the name of Amex Incorporated, which has mines or pieces of mines all over the world. During the time that I was growing up, its major holdings were copper mines in Central and Southern Africa. And when I was a kid, when I was a teenager, my father made what may have been the mistake of taking me along on business trips with him. And I began in a kind of dim way then to get the idea that the people I was seeing there, black laborers working in very hot, damp, dangerous conditions a mile under the earth for a few shillings a day, that their labor was in effect paying for my college education and for the many other good things of life that I enjoyed. And I think in some sense that was the beginning of my political awakening or coming of age.
Did you always realize that your family was rich and therefore different from most Americans?
Well, in certain basic ways, yes. I mean, I was driven to school in a limousine and things like that. But I think that what I didn't realize until these trips to Africa was beginning to get some sense of the whole imperial system that I was living in, and the fact that the money that my family had, like the money that many people in this country has, does come from exploitation in the third world, from the labor of people that you can't see and may never see in your entire life because they're halfway around the world.
You always called your father, father. And it seems to epitomize to you the formal nature of the relationship that you had with each other. How formal was it? In what ways was it formal?
Well, very much so. And in many ways, this is the real subject of the book, Half the Way Home. My father was born in the 19th century. He was born in 1892. He was really two generations older than me because he was 50 years old when I was born, married very late in life. And in some sense, I think people, especially men born that long ago, have a much harder time in dealing with emotional issues than people today. I never, ever spoke about anything to do with sex with him, for example, anything to do with my relationship with him. But he really came from an era that one didn't do that in. And I think as a result, there was always a great deal of difficulty in communicating between the two of us.
Did you know what your father wanted you to be when you grew up? Had he made that clear for you?
No, but I began to discover what he wanted for me as gradually, step by step, I departed from it. And at each step of the way, I received an intense outburst of his disapproval. And I think what he wanted for me was to go to law school, become a corporate lawyer, and then go into politics in some fashion, probably not elective politics, but appointive politics, where you get to know the right people. So, you know, when the right party comes to power, you get appointed an assistant secretary of state or something like that. That was the kind of thing that he wanted for me.
When did you start becoming active in radical politics or thinking of your politics as being left politics?
When I was 19 years old, I spent a summer working on a newspaper in South Africa, an anti-apartheid newspaper in Johannesburg and in Cape Town. This was 1962, the summer that Nelson Mandela got arrested after a nationwide manhunt, the time in South African history when the government really began clamping down very hard on the opposition. And all my friends were people who, you know, black and white, were involved in the anti-apartheid movement. Many of them had been in jail or subsequently went to jail. One man I knew fairly well was later hanged. It was, for me, the first time I had really been engaged with people who were in serious politics, where it wasn't just a matter of what opinion you voiced across a dinner table or into a microphone, but your freedom, your life itself might depend on those opinions.
Did you ever get into political arguments with your father, like so many young people have over the ages, about, I guess in your case, it might be the civil rights movement or a few years later, the war in Vietnam?
Sometimes I did. We disagreed, for example, about the issue of U.S. investment in South Africa. But more often, surprisingly enough, we were in agreement. He was a man who, despite his position as the head of a major American corporation, was really extraordinarily progressive. But we differed in matters of style and what you do. His way was writing letters to the Times. I was much more activist. I marched in demonstrations and this kind of thing.
In the mid-70s, you co-founded Mother Jones Magazine, which is, I think, now the leading magazine of the left in America. Did you think that there was a bias of the mainstream press that you wanted to have an alternative to through this new magazine?
Yes. Certainly in terms of political opinion, we were farther left than the mainstream press. We made no pretense of being, doing sort of conventional objective journalism. We had a lot of concerns for social justice and world peace and stopping U.S. interventions in other countries that were our concerns from the very, very beginning. I think Mother Jones really made its name at the start also because we practiced a kind of journalism that other publications didn't do. We did a lot of muckraking with corporate targets and really did some really path-breaking stories that got the Ford Pinto recall, that served as the basis for a number of lawsuits against the Dalkon Shield contraceptive, stories that led to legislation against the dumping of U.S. products and other faulty products in other countries. This kind of thing.
Did you invest any of the family money into the magazine when it was starting up?
Sure, and I feel great about it. It was in some sense, I mean, to the extent that the magazine stopped, defective and poisonous U.S. products being dumped on the third world, in some sense that money was maybe doing something to help the people it had been made from.
Mother Jones has done stories on mining and on strip mining, and I think that your father's company has been implicated in a couple of those stories. How do you handle conflicts like that?
Well, it was a little awkward, I must say, because certainly the particular story I remember was Mother Jones did a piece some years ago about strip mining in Wyoming, you know, where they started digging up these big coal deposits in Wyoming and northern Colorado in the middle 1970s. Mother Jones did a story on it. I commissioned the story. I was the editor working on the piece, somewhat queasy when Amex, the company that my father worked for, was one of the three or four corporations that the writer dealt with at length, but I didn't feel I could censor it. And then I went home on vacation some weeks later and found my father somewhat distressed about the story, especially because there was a picture of one of these gigantic, 10-story high bulldozers with a company name on it digging up some of this land. But he was surprisingly tolerant of that kind of thing, more so than you would have expected.
Do you feel like you made peace with your father before he died?
Very definitely. He died at the age of 88 about 5 or 6 years ago. I had had children by then. That made a big difference. His attention was focused on them, and he was very happy with them. Somehow his attention was off of me, and I no longer felt these bursts of disapproval at whatever I did. And he mellowed. I think he finally came to resign himself to the fact that he couldn't steer my life on exactly the course that he'd fantasized, and maybe also to the fact that the course that I was following wasn't such a bad one.
Okay, well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thanks for being here.
Well, thank you.
Adam Hochschild's memoir is titled Half the Way Home.